If you know one thing about J. Robert Oppenheimer, you'll know him as the father of the atomic bomb. If you know two things about Oppenheimer, you'll know that he later became a victim of the anti-communist frenzy that swept America in the 1950s, losing his security clearance as a result. If you're a scientist, you may also know Oppenheimer for his theoretical work on the gravitational collapse of neutron stars, or as one half, so to speak, of the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. I'm Margaret Harris, Physics World's Reviews Editor, and in this edition of the Books Podcast, I'll be speaking to the author of a new biography of Oppenheimer. The book's called Inside the Center. Its author is Ray Monk, and when he started writing it, he says he didn't know much more about Oppenheimer than what I've just told you. Ray Monk is not a physicist. He's a philosopher at the University of Southampton, and he's previously written biographies of the philosophers Ludwig Wittgenstein and Bertrand Russell. So why did he decide to write about Oppenheimer?
12 years ago or thereabouts, the Observer newspaper asked me to review a collection of Oppenheimer's letters, and I found the collection so fascinating that I said in the review, there's a really good biography to be written of Oppenheimer that would attempt to, you know, bring together all his many interests in literature, in Hinduism, in politics, as well as his contributions to science and his relations with other people and so on. And when I finished my Russell biography in 2001, I very much warmed to the idea and decided to do it. And it's taken me 11 years to finish it.
In the mid-2000s, there was a real run of Oppenheimer books, with no less than 5 different biographies published. Any of those books, Monk says, might have made his own project redundant. But as it turned out, none of them was quite what he'd had in mind when he wrote the review, so he carried on, and Inside the Center is the result. I spoke to Monk earlier this year as he was preparing to give a lecture at the Institute of Physics. A rather intimidating venue, Monk told me, because he isn't a physicist by training. I asked him how he dealt with the complex physics that fascinated Oppenheimer.
I had to do a lot of homework, and I needed a lot of help. And I spent a lot of time, a lot of those 11 years were spent trying to master, the ideas of quantum mechanics and the ideas of QED and so on. So I'm certainly not anywhere near the level of a professional physicist, but I'm somebody who's, made a serious attempt to understand at least the basic concepts of the work.
Was there anything in particular that you found difficult to understand, really difficult to grasp?
Well, I'm no mathematician, so as soon as physicists start using high-level mathematics, which they do often, for example, the classic work that Oppenheimer wrote on gravitational collapse includes some extraordinarily difficult mathematics, and that's way beyond me.
In their difficulties with mathematics, however, Oppenheimer and his biographer have more in common than you might expect.
Oppenheimer was noted for the fragility of his mathematics. He was very prone to making mistakes. He had a rather peculiar training as a physicist. He went to Harvard to study chemistry. He switched to physics at the end of his first year, but he, as it were, started to run before he could walk. He was doing graduate-level physics in his second year as an undergraduate, and he'd skipped an awful lot of basic training, particularly in mathematics, and that showed up in many of the works that he produced himself. Either he published them with mistakes, or if they were clear of mistakes, it's because he had them checked by somebody whose mathematics was sounder than his.
Do you think it really hurt him as a physicist, or did it do something?
There were one or two
over?
Occasions when he published a work that contained physical mistakes, mistakes in physics, because of the mistakes in mathematics. He'd got the value of a variable wrong to some great power, which undermined his work. Also, I think he was prone to thinking abstractly rather than what was often necessary, which was concretely and numerically. And I think this was at work in his conviction for about 10 years, mainly during the 1930s, his conviction that Paul Dirac's theory, field theory, had to be wrong. He had no sound basis for that, and it determined everything he did and investigated and encouraged his students to investigate. And I think that led him and his students on a number of occasions down blind alleys.
You mentioned Dirac, and there's a really revealing quote in your book from Dirac, saying that the 1920s and early 1930s were a time when a second-rate physicist could do first-rate work.
That's right. And I don't know whether Dirac thought that applied to Oppenheimer. I looked for judgments by Dirac of Oppenheimer as a physicist and didn't find any. He praised Oppenheimer late in life, But the praise was really centred on Oppenheimer's ability to get the best out of others and to organise others, and Oppenheimer's ability as an administrator and so on. However, I certainly don't feel able myself to call Oppenheimer a second-rate physicist. After all, you know, despite his gaps in mathematics, he did, you know, achieve some very notable and significant works in theoretical physics.
So you say it's possible that he was a second-rate physicist, but he certainly did first-rate work.
He did, and I think it's possible that if he'd lived a little bit longer, he might have got the Nobel Prize for his work on gravitational collapse.
The skills that Dirac most admired in Oppenheimer, his leadership, his ability to get the best out of others, came to the fore during the atomic bomb project. The project involved tens of thousands of scientists working in New Mexico and other facilities across the U.S. I asked Monk what made Oppenheimer so well suited for leading this effort, and why the project's military chief, General Groves, selected him for it.
That's an extraordinary thing because, he wasn't an experimental physicist, and he'd certainly never directed a laboratory before. And now here he is, directing the biggest laboratory that has ever been, in charge of, thousands, tens of thousands of people. And nobody, none of his fellow scientists, would have predicted that he would make a success of that. In fact, many of them predicted, it would all go belly up. The one person who had faith in him was General Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, and who, after he met Oppenheimer, said very firmly, "This is the man I want." Groves had a kind of genius. He wasn't in any general sense a genius, but he did have moments of insight, and he was a man who was prepared to go with his own judgment. And he saw something in Oppenheimer. He saw, and the reason he saw it was that when he asked scientists to explain the physics of nuclear fission and to explain how you might go about isotope separation to get the enriched uranium that one needs for the bomb and so on, they spoke in such a way that they lost him. They lost Groves. They didn't, they couldn't explain it to Groves. Oppenheimer could. When he met with Oppenheimer, Oppenheimer explained all this, and also what he saw in Oppenheimer was an urgency to get the job done. Oppenheimer was seized with the feeling that the Allies must get an atomic bomb before the Germans did.
Oppenheimer and his fellow physicists did, of course, get the atomic bomb, although not in time to use it against the Germans. Instead, the bombs they built were dropped in the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing more than 200,000 people. The Japanese surrender followed soon afterwards. But history wasn't finished with Oppenheimer yet. Long before the end of the war, he had already set in motion the chain of events that would lead to his downfall. Although Oppenheimer never joined the Communist Party, in the 1930s he had, by his own admission, been a member of pretty much every other left-wing organization on the U.S. West Coast. Shortly before he moved to New Mexico to begin work on the atomic bomb, one of his friends from that period, a man called Hakon Chevalier, paid him a visit. What happened next was, in Ray Monk's words, bewildering.
Basically, Hakon Chevalier tried to enlist Oppenheimer into an espionage attempt to leak secrets about the atomic weapons project to the Soviet Union, and Oppenheimer refused to do it. He should have done either of two things. He should have immediately reported that to the security people, or he should have kept quiet about it. And he didn't. He did something halfway between those things. He did the worst possible thing. He reported it, but first of all, he refused to name Chevalier, and then he told a lie. He said that there were three people, or that he was one of three people that had been approached. And I think he just underestimated both the intelligence and the tenacity of the agents that he was dealing with. Boris Pash, who was one of these security people, was absolutely determined to get the truth out of Oppenheimer. And eventually, with General Groves' help, he did get the truth. But in the process, Oppenheimer had revealed himself as somebody who was prepared to mislead the security people, was prepared to lie to them, and so on. And so at his famous security hearing in 1954, the people who were gunning for him, all they had to do, which they did over and over again, was just point out that he'd lied. And he had lied. And that lie was to haunt him for the rest of his life and to destroy Chevalier's life.
The rest of Oppenheimer's life amounted to another 12 years. During this time, he was director of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. And eventually, he enjoyed a reconciliation of sorts with the U.S. government. But his career as a nuclear insider was finished. So what are we to make of J. Robert Oppenheimer? He was sloppy at mathematics, it seems, but a gifted physicist. A natural leader, he could also be a shockingly poor judge of character, as he was with his security agents and, perhaps, Chevalier himself. It's little wonder that his biographer describes him as an enigma.
What did you make of him as a person? You spent the last, say, 11 years.
I think the word that comes to mind, when one thinks of Oppenheimer, is enigmatic. He was extraordinarily complicated and difficult to understand. I think the person who understood him best was Isidore Rabi, who said that Oppenheimer was made up of bright, shining splinters, which never quite came together, never quite cohered into an integral whole. And that's frustrating for a biographer. One wants an integral whole as a biographer. But there just didn't seem to be one in Oppenheimer's case. And so what you're forced to do then in the biography is try and tie up as many of these splinters as you can, try and show why the man who learns Sanskrit in order to master the Hindu classics is the same man who's obsessively trying to understand mesons and gravitational collapse and so on. And sometimes you can do it and sometimes you can't. And where you can't, you just have to present these bright, shining splinters, as it were, in all their spectacular glory.
Now, you titled your book Inside the Center, because
yeah.
The central bit you made of his character is that he was always trying to be at the heart of things.
Yeah.
Is there a bit of a conflict in that Oppenheimer himself seems like comes across as a man who doesn't seem to have a center?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point. And I think that's a theme running throughout my book, that he's wanting to be at the center of physics, he's wanting to be at the center of politics later on. This idea of being at the center and of, addressing the centrally important questions, that idea is a central, recurring motif throughout his life. And I agree, it does sit strangely with one of the most striking things about him, which is that his own centre remained extraordinarily elusive. As he said himself once that, he was very, very good at hiding things from people, and he was extraordinarily good at it.
Even from his biographer?
Even from his biographer, from his wife, from his kids, from his close friends, from his colleagues, all of them felt that he was keeping things from them. There are over 260 boxes of his papers in the Library of Congress, and I've been through all of them, and remarkably few of them have anything of any intimate or revealing nature. You just have to keep piecing things together, picking up hints here and there. It was a great challenge, but it's also, quite exciting, I think.
There's much more we could say about Oppenheimer, but I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Ray Monk for sharing his thoughts, and thank you for listening to the Physics World Books podcast. I'm Margaret Harris, and I'll be back soon with another edition. In the meantime, please check out our website, physicsworld.com, for more physics news, reviews, and analysis. Thanks for listening.